Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Trump in Davos edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon, joined by Anna Szymanski and Jordan Weissman. And in Davos, Switzerland, or Davos, as I guess we should call it this week, we have Jacob Weisberg.
Hello, Felix. Hello, money people.
You are right there in the thick of it all. This is the year that Davos, which has always been this conference which was like full of wonky economists and finance ministers and high-minded talk about the state of the world, just completely got obliterated, first by a snowstorm and then by Donald Trump. He kind of took over every conversation, right?
Yeah, it was clearly the only headline that was going to come out of Davos this year was about whatever Trump said. And in that sense, it was very shrewd, you know, that everyone assumed that Davos represented a good part of what Trump and Trump's constituency is hostile to, i.e. globalization. But with Steve Bannon gone, there was nothing preventing him from coming here, and he sold his message pretty effectively. I mean, he gave a very conciliatory speech without a lot of substance, but I think the story is going to be largely a positive one about his visit. And in fairness, Davos probably is a kind of civilizing influence on Donald Trump. It's probably a good thing for him to come here, speak to some other world leaders, behave like a normal human being to some extent. I don't know that it's a disaster for anybody.
So he was always like the avatar of everything that Davos wasn't. You know, he's the anti-trade agreements, anti-immigration, anti-equality, like America comes first and the rest of you can all go to hell in a handbasket. If there was one politician in the world who was in opposition to everything that Davos stands for, it was Donald Trump. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Well, he came with a message that was a message a lot of people come to Davos with, which is invest in what I'm selling. So his message was very much invest in America. It's a great place to do business. We're getting rid of all the regulations that would make it hard to do things. We've cut corporate taxes and the sort of open for business. That was the line. And that's not so different from what leaders of a lot of countries around the world come to Davos to say. They make their pitch.
The open for business is this cliche, right? It's like this weird obligatory thing that every single world leader has to say in their speech at Davos is, my country is open for business.
I mean, in this case, though, I was about to call it a euphemism, but it's not even real. I mean, he's just coming and saying, hey, I just cut taxes right. A bunch. Thank you very much. You're welcome. Like, that's his message. It's, you know, I just gave you a lot of money, global investors. Like, I cut taxes on capital. And beyond that, I'm getting rid of regulations you didn't like. It's not like he even has to sell that very hard. That's red meat for Davos.
So I guess that's the real question, which I have for you, Jacob, is, like, we know what Trump said. The question is, how was it received? Among a crowd who you and I both know love nothing more than being unbelievably rude about this guy from the minute he stepped onto the world scene, have they softened their opposition to him now?
I think they have, and I think that happened even before his speech. His people have been here all week, and they've been treated, I mean, it's not just normalization of the administration. They've been treated reverentially. I don't think they've been challenged in any serious way. And the, you know, the Davos types, the bankers and the hedge fund managers and the CEOs, they love the tax cut, and they are, I think, sincerely convinced that Trump is having a very positive effect on the economy now. I mean, everybody who's invested in markets is having a very, very good year.
So this is not the home of the resistance then.
I mean, you know, Trump was, he was booed for one moment in his speech when he said fake news, which was, you know, as he should have been. But other than that, I mean, there are certainly a lot of people who are sort of sitting on their hands, and, you know, there are lots of people here who are no fans of Donald Trump. That's for sure. But he has not, I don't think he has experienced a hostile reception in any way, nor have any of his people.
So that doesn't surprise me if we're talking about people in finance, but I'm wondering about other world leaders. How do we know how they have been reacting to him?
Yeah, what about the Africans in particular? I mean, after that shithole country's statement, like, you would think at least the Africans might be a little bit opposed to his presence. And
they were supposed to walk out, weren't they?
I don't believe that happened. He did not have, I think he was meant to have a bilateral meeting with Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. I didn't actually hear any report, if there was one, on what transpired. But, you know, dealing with Trump, if you're another world leader, is a question of strategy. Probably Macron in France has figured out how to play him most effectively, which is, you know, give him a big parade and a military band. You know, don't make fun of him to his face and try to manipulate him.
Is it true that Macron is the guy we have to thank for persuading him to go to Davos in the first place?
I did hear some version of that. I don't know where the idea came from, but that certainly seems like a plausible scenario.
I'm thinking back to a conversation, I think last year we had Davos's PR guy come on, right?
Adrian,
and he and I got into a fight about
a very good PR guy, by the way, a former serious journalist.
Yeah, we were talking. We had a fight where Adrian was talking about, you know, Davos and the people were showing up there, and, you know, how they were thinking about inequality, and, you know, how global corporations and global capital were going to deal with it. And I just my impulse was to call bullshit, because these are the people who are going to benefit from it, who benefit from all these trends, and they don't really have a stake in stopping them. And I think now, you know, you see how you see what Davos is really about in the end, which is global capital and the politicians who they influence getting together. And why are they warming to Trump? Why are they happy with him? Because nobody since arguably Reagan has given more to capital than this president. Even if he's done it in his own haphazard, inept way, he has still delivered something that nobody else has. And so it's just that's what it boils down to. It boils down to returns, ROI, and they are getting it.
I think you've nailed it, Jordan.
That's it. That's all. That's the whole thing. Sorry. Anyway, I just want to claim vindication there.
So the other thing which may or may not have been surprising was that Trump clearly loved Davos. He had this big smile on his face. He was walking around the convention center, glad handing people. There were crowds everywhere he went. There were no protests anywhere. He was getting amazing softball questions from Klaus Schwab. And he really looked and felt like he was in his element. Almost more than, say, even Bill Clinton, who has always been the sort of apotheosis of Davos Man. Do you think that, like, number one, this means that he loved it so much he's just going to come back at every opportunity? And number two, that he's kind of single-handedly changed the whole conception of what Davos is, to Jordan's point, from being like a high-minded talking shop where we get to intone about inequality and poverty, to just being a sort of celebration of investment and growth and capitalism.
Well, those things swing back and forth, right? So when the economy's bad, you can talk more about poverty and inequality, but when it's booming, the sort of true colors come out in a way. I think he will be back, and as I say, I think it's probably a civilizing influence on him. In terms of why he loved it so much, you know, I think you have to remember the sort of Queen's Donald Trump, who feels this sort of sting of rejection from an establishment, and you know, I think in the old days, he probably was never invited to Davos. And I think he probably really wanted to be invited to Davos. And now he's not only invited, he's begged to come to Davos, and he goes on his own terms, and he experiences this tremendous bootlicking sycophancy from everyone. Why wouldn't he like it? It's the ultimate vindication for him.
Awesome.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay. But let's move on to his oleaginous underling.
Oh, my God. Steve Mnuchin.
Mr. Steve Mnuchin.
The man you can neither take seriously or literally.
So Steve Mnuchin managed to come out over the course of Davos with two diametrically opposed dollar policies. He arrives on his first day and gives an impromptu press conference. He's like, yeah, the weak dollar is great. We don't care about the dollar. And then, like, by the end of the week, he's coming out saying, no, a strong dollar is in the national interest. And I am so happy, Jacob, that we have you on this show to be able to decipher Treasury Secretary Yi's, because you know more about how all of these statements work than anyone else. So what happened?
Well, I think what Felix might be referring to is I did write a book with Bob Rubin after he left the Clinton administration, where he was Treasury Secretary. And Rubin was the essence of a discipline on the subject of talking about the dollar. And he was very much of the view that you should essentially never say anything about the dollar. You should make a formulaic statement that you repeat verbatim every time, because you don't want to be moving markets accidentally by saying different things and improvising. And you probably don't want to be trying to move currency markets intentionally, because it's a dangerous game that often backfires and probably can't work in any long-term way to affect the direction of currencies. So, but currency markets are very twitchy and respond to everything.
So this is really interesting. Like the formula that Rubin came up with, and which was then slavishly followed by, to a greater or lesser extent, by basically all of his successors until Mnuchin, was, repeat after me, a strong dollar is in the national interest. And what you're saying is that was just words, that it was never designed to have any actual meaning. It was just meant to be a formula he could trot out to say, I'm not going to say anything about the dollar.
Well, I do think it had meaning. I mean, you could come up with a formulation of that statement that would, that's a statement that indicates you have no problem with the dollar being strong. That's good for the country. And there are many people who have the view that a weaker dollar promotes exports
including
and trade.
Including
Donald Trump, right? But at one point, even during the Clinton administration, I remember Rubin varied that statement after great thought and discussion. And I think what they said was, the dollar has been strong for a good while now. That was taken to mean that they would not be so opposed to the dollar going down and don't expect them to try to do anything to prop it up.
So I've been sort of baffled by this whole thing, just watching it unfold. Like when Mnuchin said, you know, a weaker dollar might be good for trade, like the dollar, markets went nuts. The dollar fell immediately to like a 3-year low because somehow they thought that meant the administration would have a weak dollar policy. And the thing that strikes me as like kind of nuts about that is there's very, very, very little a Treasury Secretary can actually do to influence the value of the dollar.
Beyond opening his mouth.
Exactly. It's all self-fulfilling prophecies. There are things that a Treasury Secretary, the Fed can do it. The Fed can buy foreign currencies or sell them and try to drive down the dollar the way other central banks drive down their currencies. And there are things the Treasury can do in concert with the Fed if everyone is willing to cooperate. But really, Mnuchin, like he's got, there's like this one account that the US has to kind of play with the foreign exchange markets. That's like the equivalent of an old 401k. Everyone has forgotten about it. It's so tiny. There's like, he has very little firepower on this. And yet his words carry so much meaning. And that is like, I guess I just don't get why. I don't get, like, is it other than just like the markets are naturally twitchy? What is it that
I think it's both. As Jacob was saying, when you've had a standard,
yeah,
and then you deviate from that standard, that makes it more meaningful. And also, yes, markets are stupid, especially currency markets. They're, especially in the short term, can react to things and start pricing in things that are far into the future and make no sense.
Yeah, I just like, because I went back, yeah. I read about Rubin's first statement, the first time he used that formulation, a strong dollar is in the national interest, and at least there was a little bit of policy meat there, because it turns out that was at a point when the dollar had been falling for a long time, and they were trying to prop it back up by creating this, like, international, there was an international effort to prop up the dollar that he was coordinating, more or less. So, like, that at least kind of, I get why that statement was meaningful, and now it just seems to become this piety.
I think it's also because the dollar has recently been weak, and this came right after the announcements of the tariffs, which, yes, are not actually that meaningful, but I think coming on the heels of that made it.
But you know what's ironic about that? Okay.
No.
Jacob, I feel like we keep running over you.
No, well, I was just going to say there have been currency interventions, and when they happen, they work best if no one is expecting them. But the Treasury coordinates with the Fed, and they typically, when they've ever been effective, they're coordinated with other governments, particularly the central banks in Asian countries where they're very large foreign currency reserves, and these reserves are not so large that they can ultimately affect the value of the currency, but they can't affect the direction. And there have been these instances where concerted, unexpected, strong interventions have changed the direction of currencies. But this is a tool that you want to use very seldom, if ever, but you want to keep your powder dry. You don't want to be signaling all the time about what you might do. And, you know, it's one of these things that had become a kind of bipartisan consensus. You know, when they give you the keys to the Treasury Department, they tell you where the washroom is. And by the way, don't say anything stupid about the dollar. And, you know, Republican administrations and Democratic administrations had come to an agreement that this was a good way for the government to act. And it's just an example, I think, of just the kind of novice incompetence, unsophistication of the Trump people when it comes to the sort of grown-up work of running the government. You know, shooting your mouth off about the dollar, and, you know, when the Treasury Secretary has to be corrected by the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, when they have to wake him up in a meeting to say, you know, the Treasury Secretary has really gone off the reservation about the dollar, it just sends a signal to the rest of the world that, you know, the B team is in charge here.
And the rest of the world is all in Davos, right? Every single central bank governor, finance minister, they're all there. They all read the headlines upon Mnuchin's arrival. And then they all need to sort of meet with him. We understand Trump has this kind of unique outsized aura of Trump, which follows him around, but Mnuchin has no aura of anything. So how has he been received in Davos?
I went to a panel he did. Actually, I think it was it was televised live on CNBC. They sponsor some of the events here. And he was the headline. He had just made his dollar should be lower comment. And so this was the place where he had to kind of sheepishly correct it. And, he's just very unimpressive. I mean, he's been marching around with a large entourage. I've sort of crossed paths with him several times. But, you know, there are people who have credibility at Davos. Many of the central bank governors. Our friend Martin Wolf, the economist, you know, whenever he's talking to somebody, you see a little crowd gathering around because everyone wants to hear what he has to say. Steve Mnuchin, not so much.
I just want to call back to something again, Felix, which was when we were first talking about Mnuchin after he got selected as Treasury Secretary. And I think we actually agreed on this at the time, which was that he was going to be an adult standard issue Treasury Secretary who'd be perfectly fine at the job and uncontroversial, that it seemed like this was just a vanilla pick. And I think we can both say we were wrong. Like, we've managed to get like a below replacement Treasury Secretary. And that was actually one of the surprises of the Trump administration. He was supposed to be one of the, he was supposed to be balanced.
I mean, couldn't he just do a Jack Lew and be completely invisible? That would be a vast improvement.
Absolutely. He'd then be a replacement level.
Okay. Enough of Treasury Secretaries.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
But Jacob, of course, this is the World Economic Forum. It's not just this American entourage. We have had a whole bunch of heads of state, Narendra Modi, Macron from France, and others, including my own Theresa May, bless her, giving speeches and trying to turn Davos. I'm going to say I'm not there, so you're going to have to tell me. But has Davos become much more centered on sort of international politics and what the heads of state are doing rather than looking at the finance ministers and the central bank governors and the kind of nuts and bolts of the workings of the economy? Has this become more of a political event now?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've sorted it out, but I think increasingly there are multiple worlds that operate in parallel here. So you still have the central bank governor, Davos, where they're having one set of meetings. You have the world leaders making public statements and interacting with each other. And those are, they're increasingly all here or almost all here. Certainly the European leaders, and you know, they're trying to, they're doing different things, but there's sort of that stage. Then there's the sort of NGO care about the rest of the world, inequality and poverty Davos. And that still goes on, but almost on a separate track. You have journalist Davos, you have, you know, all the discussion around technology and the technology platforms that have an increasing presence.
And this
here,
year,
I
mean, of course,
Facebook
is cryptocurrency Davos, right? Everyone, there's
yes,
a big,
and you have Bitcoin Davos, Bitcoin Davos. And you know, the cliche of the year is definitely blockchain, which, you know, you can hear people bluffing about in sort of just about any session. So, you know, you have these things, and I'm not sure those worlds touch. I mean, you have CEOs who come to Davos because it's a very efficient way to schedule meetings with each other and with clients, and they'll sit in a hotel suite and have half-hour meetings for the entire week, and they can get in 50, 60 meetings, and they may not even have any public presence at all or anything to do with the public program. So it's just, it's a multiple ring circus now.
You know, Jacob, the way you're talking about blockchain Davos and finance minister Davos, it's like, it sounds like you're talking about Twitter with more private helicopters, like just like these little like these little cliques kind of floating around, but it's Twitter IRL and richer.
And what you're describing also sounds very similar to banking conferences, which is they take place at hotels and you set up your group meetings. You never want to get into a group meeting because they're useless. You try to get into your one-on-ones. You have to like butter up your salesperson so you can get those one-on-ones, and they're often in hotel rooms. It's so, it sounds like Davos is becoming much more like that.
Way to demystify
painful,
it.
Right?
But at least this year, everyone gets to complain about the snow, right? There's like a boring topic of conversation, which everyone can like talk about snow. Is that really a thing?
Well, part of the reason it works, it was I came a day late on Tuesday when they'd sort of got things going again. But apparently on Monday, it took people hours and hours to get to Davos from the Zurich airport. It should take 2 or 2.5 hours. And I think it took people 6. So that was a bit of a pain for people who got stuck in it. But, you know, part of the reason Davos works in all these ways for the people who come here is because once you come here, you're sort of trapped. I think after 1 year, didn't they do Davos in New York 1 year?
They did. That was after 9/11. They moved it to New York. After 9/11. Solidarity.
And that wouldn't work at all, you know, because people in New York are in New York and will go to an event. But when you're in Davos and when you're in the forum, in World Economic Forum in Davos, you're here. There's nowhere else to go. And so you have 100% of the attention of the people while they're in the place. I do think the isolation is the brilliant innovation.
And in terms of the heads of state, though, tell me if I'm wrong here, but there seems to have been a kind of convergence that the speeches they give have all started merging into each other. And there's just this sort of standard Davos speech, which you give when you go to Davos. And like it doesn't really matter who you're listening to. It's all, you know, platitudes about how we're open for business and a great place for investment and we want good trade deals. And, is that new, or did it always happen and no one really cared about it? I'm trying to work out whether anything is changing.
It's a place you can give a very boring speech or a very interesting speech. There's nothing that prevents you from being interesting if you want to. And there are, you know, last year you were here, Felix. I think Xi Jinping gave this speech.
She was interesting. Has anyone committed news in Davos this year, which would like,
you know, other than Mnuchin, other than our inept Treasury Secretary,
other than by accidentally saying the truth, which is that I have no control over currencies?
Well, Xi Jinping's thing last year was, you know, the United States is going to abdicate all this world leadership, and hey, China wants to take it on. Curiously, that slot was taken a little bit by Justin Trudeau, much more benignly. You know, saying that they were going to step in a way on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, on the Asian trade deal that the United States is pulling out of. And I think that actually put some pressure on Trump to reference it in his speech and say something mildly mollifying about we're very open to doing fair trade deals with the Asian countries one by one or even all as a group. Of course, they would be based on his idea of trade reciprocity, which is based on equality of result, not equality of opportunity. But, you know, Trudeau's speech, I think, got a lot of attention because when the United States abdicates moral leadership, but also more specific kinds of leadership around trade, around climate change, this is a question of, is it possible for someone to step in? And Merkel steps in very quietly. Macron and Trudeau are interested in being a little more visible in that role of doing the things that a healthy United States would be doing on a global stage.
Interesting, because everyone kind of assumed that in the global leadership vacuum, which was created by Trump's election, would be filled by Merkel, but she now is in a very precarious position. So it's actually the next generation. It's Macron and Trudeau who seem to be now sort of stepping into that gap.
And it's very encouraging, I think. I mean, I find both of them very, very appealing young leaders. And I think they're both articulate and interesting and you seem like they're, you know, Merkel may not be around forever. She's been in office how long, Felix? 12 years? Something
like
that?
At least 1,000.
1,000. Wow. Okay. But I mean, I think there's also something just sort of inherently appealing about Canadian leadership, at least. Like,
and his socks.
Yeah.
His socks
but
great.
Like, seriously, like, it, you know, a world.
Did you say that during the Mulroney years, Jordan?
Right now, like, you know, you talk about the trade deal, right? I forget what they renamed TPP to.
CTPP.
Yeah, they had to have a rebranding of it. But the final deal they're signing is actually, I would say, better for the world than what TPP was, because it's got less of the crazy IP protections that the U.S. was insisting on. And the U.S. has a lot of corporate interest, and there's a great article in The Atlantic about this. But you know, the U.S. has a lot of corporate interests that are not so much in the interest of the rest of the globe and the rest of the globe's poor or people in developing countries like Vietnam. So a softer, gentler Canadian-led global trade order, at least slightly softer, slightly gentler Canadian-led global trade order is kind of nice, I think.
It's a worthwhile Canadian initiative.
There we go. I was waiting for it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, on which note, let's have a numbers round. Jacob, I know that you're always extremely well prepared and so that you have a number off the top of your head.
Felix, your excellent producer, Martin, who's helping put the show together, reminded me that you need a number when you go on Slate Money. So I scrambled and came up with one. But here is my number, 2.05 million. Any guesses? That is the number of jobs added to the economy in 2017, which Trump was boasting about his prowess at job creation. But what's interesting about that number, it is the lowest annual job creation number of the past 7 years. Mm-hmm. That is, since the recovery began under Barack Obama. There's not a huge range. The highest year, according to the labor statistics, was 2.993 million jobs. But Trump's job creation performance was actually the weakest since the recovery began.
Jordan?
My number is 18, as in 18 carat, as in the 18 carat gold toilet that the Guggenheim Museum offered the White House. The backstory here is that apparently the White House requested a Van Gogh for the Trump president's private residence that he and Melania wanted, or their interior decorator wanted. And this is tradition. Presidents often do this. But the Guggenheim said, no, we cannot offer you that Van Gogh. We are sorry. However, we can give you this 18 karat gold toilet that artist Maurizio Catalan, a great Italian, I think it's described as like a prankster a lot, but this great Italian artist had installed at the Guggenheim, and the piece is titled America. And the idea was just he was representing America, and it's a functioning toilet. You can go and use it. People have lined up to do it. And the idea was that America could be best symbolized by a actual Golden John, which at the time it came out, he put this thing out. People sort of assumed this was at least partly a reference to Donald Trump. He has sort of been cagey about that. But the White House has so far not accepted the toilet. I think the only way to come back from this sick burn is to take it. To say, you know what? We want the golden toilet. Donald Trump likes golden toilets. This is the world's nicest golden toilet. He should have it. Anyway, that's my take.
Don't know how I can follow that.
Donald Trump a golden toilet.
Yeah, he should have his damn golden toilet.
Coles to Newcastle, as they say.
So my number is 12, as in 12 years. So there is one former world leader who is definitely not at Davos, and that is Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who this week lost an appeal on his corruption conviction. So it looks like he is most likely not going to be able to participate in the elections. We'll still see. But I just bring this up because we actually do have a lot of important elections coming up, and Brazil is one of them, and the current candidates are awful.
But so is he actually going to be in jail?
His passport was taken away.
Can he run from jail?
That's another good question. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure he cannot. And the guy who's running in second is truly this horrible right-winger, ultra-conservative, who has said, who his last name is Bolsonaro, who, when he voted to impeach Dilma Rousseff, actually said that he was his vote was in honor of the person who tortured Dilma Rousseff.
Wow.
So, oh, just saying.
Wow.
This is, it's a somewhat interesting development.
So my number is 1.581 trillion dollars. This is the annual report that Oxfam puts out about inequality on the first day of Davos, and I have been very rude about this report many times, and I actually quite like it this year for reasons which you can read on my blog, Cause and Effect. But the thing which didn't make it into the report, really, or not explicitly anyway, you had to kind of do a lot of rootling around in the footnotes, was that the bottom 50% of the world, according to Credit Suisse, has $1.581 trillion of net wealth, which is way up from what they thought it was last year. Last year, they thought it was $409 billion. This is like, it's basically quadrupled. The average net wealth for the bottom 50% has basically been revised upwards from $110 a person to $427 a person. And this is, I just think, a little data point worth celebrating. Obviously, the actual amount of wealth didn't go up that much in the year, but they discovered $8 trillion worth of wealth that they didn't realize existed in places like India and China and Russia. And a lot of that was in the bottom 50%. And it turns out the bottom 50% are a little bit richer than we thought they were.
Felix, what changed in how they calculated? Did they move to purchasing power, or did they just, what's the, there must be some difference in how they're conceiving of it.
So there's a lot of minor methodological changes, but mainly what they did was they just had new data sources in India and China and Russia, all of which managed to reveal a certain amount of wealth which had not previously been counted. It's basically in those three countries. But anyway, yeah, I think we can wrap up the Davos show for another year. It's been a weird one. It's been a strange one. But next year we will come back with another Davos show. But for this year and for this week, I think that's it. So yeah, so thank you for listening to Slate Money. Do keep on writing to us. It's slatemoney@slate.com. Listen to Amicus, which comes out every other week on Saturday morning.
Amicus. No one knows it. Amicus, for the love of God.
It's called, well, I mean, you know, Americans might call it Amicus. I still believe that there is such a thing as an Amicus brief, and they're wonderful things. It's at slate.com/amicus. On Saturday mornings, along with Slate Money. So after you've listened to Slate Money, you can listen to Amicus. It's Dahlia Lithwick talking jurisprudence and all manner of sexy things there. Jacob, as a true Anglophile, will you accept Amicus as a alternative pronunciation, or am I just on my own here?
I will not file an Amicus brief in your defense. I've never heard that pronunciation before. It definitely took me a minute to figure out what you were talking about.
It sounds like a plant.
It's a ficus, but...
Okay, so tune in next week, and thanks for listening to Slate Money. Oh, thanks to Dan Schrader for being, like, producer-y.